Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome to Spotlight on Youth. I hope everyone tuning in is having a good week and is beginning to thaw out. My name is Lauren Litton, and I'm the host of this radio show that is dedicated to social and legal trends impacting the rights and well-being of children across the country. Spotlight on Youth is a project of the Children's Law Center, Inc., a not-for-profit children's rights legal services organization. This radio show is being streamed live over the Internet and will be available on demand after its conclusion. We encourage you to participate in the show by asking questions. To do so, dial 347-994-1149. That's 347-994-1149, and press the number 1 on your telephone keypad to indicate you have a question, and you'll be placed in a queue. Also, feel free to log into the chat room and pose questions there. Joining us today is Brooke Burns to provide an overview of the Adam Walsh Act as it pertains to youth and Ohio's implementation of that act through Senate Bill 10. Brooke is an assistant state public defender in the Juvenile Division of the Office of the Ohio Public Defender. She specializes in post-disposition advocacy, representing youth in appeals, post-conviction actions, and in release and reentry proceedings. A significant portion of Brooke's work is dedicated to representing youth who are subject to classification and registration under Ohio's version of the Sex Offender Registration Notification Act, both at the juvenile and appellate court levels. Brooke, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
We are really so fortunate to have you as a guest. I appreciate the time you're taking and know it's been a very busy week for you. In fact, you've had 2 oral arguments in front of the Ohio Supreme Court this week on the very issues you're planning to discuss with us. I'm sure our listeners would really like to know about those cases and the underlying challenges, but before we discuss all of those facets, I'd like you to give an overview of the issue of sex offender classification, registration, notification for juveniles. And I also want to clarify for our audience that this show is focused on the legal issues around the Adam Walsh Act. We will not be discussing treatment options for youth who offend. We are currently organizing a show that will highlight some programs in Ohio. So if you have questions or interest in learning about treatment and intervention programs, please look for that upcoming show. So, Brooke, let's start at the very beginning. What is the Adam Walsh Act?
Well, the Adam Walsh Child Protection and Safety Act is a federal enactment that encompasses a wide range of initiatives which were designed to protect children from abuse, sexual exploitation, and victimization. It contains regulations on civil commitments for sex offenders, immigration reform related to those convicted of sex offenses, initiatives to stop child pornography, trafficking, and information on grants and federal funding towards those same efforts. The part of the act that states defenders and child advocates are most familiar with, however, is Title I, which is the Sex Offender Registration and Notification Act, also known as SORNA. SORNA is the system by which the government monitors individuals who've been convicted of sex offenses. It requires the frequency and duration of registration. It also requires that specific information on registrants be kept with local law enforcement officer. And all of this is supposed to give law enforcement the ability to track and readily find registrants wherever they might be in the state. And for adult registrants, and sadly some children registrants, it also places their information on the World Wide Web, so it's available to anyone who might try to look it up. Adam Walsh, essentially, the act took to the previous scheme, Megan's Law, and kind of pushed everything further. The law lists the names of 16 children and adults who were victimized over the past few decades, along with the name of the son of John Walsh, the host of America's Most Wanted. That's where the act derives its name. So that's kind of an overview, but it's a system by which law enforcement can regulate and track convicted sex offenders.
So, you know, this show, we really focus on juvenile justice issues. How does this all connect to that?
Well, sadly, even though the act was supposed to protect children, it requires states to register youth who are 14 years of age and older in ways that are very close to the ways that adults are required to register. These requirements have caused a fundamental shift in the way that juvenile adjudications are typically treated. For instance, the act defines juvenile adjudications as convictions for the purpose of registration and categorizes children into the same tier structure as adult registrants. For some youth, this means that for an offense that occurred when they were a child, they'll now be registering for the rest of their lives. So the provisions of SORNA require youth to register not only through the jurisdiction of the juvenile court, but now beyond the jurisdiction of the juvenile court. So you'll now have children who age out of the system and are 24, 25, up to, 75, who will still be registering based on an adjudication that occurred when they were a teen. The act also requires that children be classified to their respective tiers based solely on their offense, which means there's no consideration to that child's amenability to rehabilitation and treatment. There's no consideration to the circumstances or the facts of that child's case or anything that would enable a governing body to make a decision based on the needs of that child. In essence, the federal enactment has removed the juvenile court's discretion in a way that undermines the rehabilitative nature of the juvenile system. And it makes a judgment about a child's dangers to the community without actually evaluating the specifics of his or her case. And this is a drastic departure from the way in which juvenile dispositions are traditionally crafted. Until the most recent set of guidelines from the Department of Justice, Smart Office, were released, the act required that all juvenile offender registrants be placed on the web, just like adults. And this also is a huge departure from the way that kids are typically treated. The Smart Office, and I didn't say what that was, sorry.
Yeah, and if you can also do review what SORNA is. I mean, I have a feeling that some of our audience may not be familiar with all the acronyms.
Oh, no problem. SORNA is Sex Offender Registration and Notification Act. So it's specifically the part of Adam Walsh that details the registration process itself and the requirements of registration. The SMART Office is the Sex Offender Sentencing, Monitoring, Apprehending, Registering, and Tracking Office. So it's basically been the governing body that determines what changes about SORNA or what guidelines are released with SORNA. So it kind of helps give direction to the states that are trying to pass the legislation on their own or trying to formulate the legislation. So that's SORNA and SMART, which, was an attempt to make it easier, I guess, to identify the different pieces of the law.
Mm-hmm.
But the most recent SMART guidelines have actually no longer tied compliance with SORNA to placement of children on the web. So that's actually a better development than the way that the law was when it was first enacted.
So, what does that mean, really?
when it started, the whole idea, and I mean it still is quite offensive, juvenile adjudications have historically been hidden from the public eye. That's one of the things about the juvenile system that insulates children from being labeled as criminal, is the idea that the entire public doesn't have to know about a juvenile's adjudication. Unlike the adult system, which is built on principles of transparency and of the public being aware of kind of what's going on in their community, the juvenile system has had the exact opposite history, in that the juvenile system is not meant to penalize children, but its primary goals are to be the rehabilitation and meeting the needs of the child. Publication of children's information on the web is a significant departure from that, in that we're no longer simply worried about whether a child may be rehabilitated, but now we're worried about letting everyone else in the world essentially know about this youth's adjudication. Interestingly enough, the case that I argued yesterday in the Ohio Supreme Court was challenging just that aspect of Ohio's version of Adam Walsh, which is the public nature of registration for children. The idea that's posted is what we're challenging.
Okay. And you've jumped way into all of the issues around, you know, how the application to youth, which is wonderful and started to talk about even in Ohio, but I still kind of want to take a little bit of step back to provide a more context. And even though it's really only been 3 years, but if you can talk about how the federal law, what the federal government did to ask the states, you know, what were the incentives to comply with this and what Ohio did, because it was one mm-hmm. of the first states, right, to adopt something that would be in compliance with the Adam Walsh Act. So if you can just kind of give us some background about that, that would be really helpful.
Sure. What the federal government did was essentially give states an ultimatum that if they did not enact versions of the Adam Walsh Act, that they would risk losing 10% of their federal justice assistance funding. Specifically, the funding that states will lose if they don't enact by the deadline, and I'll talk about the shifting deadline in a moment, but if they don't enact by the deadline, they will lose 10% of the grant that helps them equip and train their law enforcement programs. It also helps keep their prosecution programs and crime prevention programs running. So it's a nice chunk of a state's justice system funding that would be taken away if the states fail to implement Adam Walsh. The original deadline for implementing was July 26, 2009. However, just the barriers that states have run into and jurisdictions have had in implementing or in trying to even draft the legislation have caused states to ask for extensions. The current deadline is now July 27th, 2011, that states have to comply. And given that, as of now, only 7 jurisdictions are actually in substantial compliance, I'm imagining some states are still anticipating asking for even further extension. I think the main reason for all these extensions has been that the law itself is so burdensome and its requirements are so cumbersome that states are still grappling with whether the payoff of losing 10% of law enforcement funding is worth it. In many cases, when local general assemblies start the revision process, the way that the federal act is written, they can't just simply insert the federal guidelines into their own statutes, but the federal requirements require a lot of states to actually make significant changes to their criminal statutes and recategorizing their own sexually oriented offenses. And that's really a massive undertaking, considering the number of offenses that are out there that fall into the registration eligible categories now. And I found that some states just don't like the new requirements. The juvenile provisions alone have given states a lot of pause over implementing such a drastic change to the registration system. Many jurisdictions are offended and just cautious about imposing these types of consequences on children. And not only that, the cost of it is astounding. Since Adam Walsh requires that the changes in SORNA be retroactively applied, the magnitude of the cost of supervising all these previous offenders under more strict requirements may actually outweigh the threat of losing funding. We found, at least locally here, that cost was a huge problem in the opening months, because you had individuals who were originally sexually oriented offenders, which were the lowest level of offenders under old law, who now all became tier threes when they were reclassified under Senate Bill 10. And that really caused a lot of upheaval because you just had way too many people for the sheriffs to really keep an eye on. And it started to kind of defeat the purpose of having this type of system. To date, the 7 jurisdictions that have reached substantial compliance are Ohio, Delaware, Florida, South Dakota, the U.S. territory of Guam, and 2 Native American tribes. In order to get the state or states to get the ball rolling more on this, the government's now providing grant money to assist states in becoming compliant. So states can apply for funding that would help them implement the act in their own jurisdictions. And then hopefully, I guess, the government's take is that by giving that incentive, that this will get more states in compliance by the deadline.
I know that I recently saw something that Texas had issued two reports. It's saying that the cost of implementing SORNA there would be $14 million, with only a loss of $2.2 million from the federal government if they didn't do it. And then I think the Justice Policy Institute once came out with an average for states would be, it would cost $38.5 million to implement, but most states would only lose about $1.5 million in burn money, which was the money that you were sort of referring to for the law enforcement.
Right.
And this is about, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, there's challenges to Adam Walsh Act and the registration and classification on both the adult and juvenile side, correct? I mean, that
yes.
People are wondering if this has been effective.
Yes, there's definitely issues running the gamut from procedural errors to constitutional claims. I think even before the act actually went into effect, defense bar, child advocates, and even some victims' rights organizations were banding together to try and to keep this from happening. But once it was realized that, you know, Ohio was well ahead of the game, so to speak, then there became a scramble to pull challenges together and to really get into courts and start litigating it early.
Well, I know you've been involved with some of the challenges from the very beginning. So maybe you can talk a little bit about Senate Bill 10, which is Ohio's implementation of Adam Walsh,
mm-hmm.
some of the provisions, and then the immediate challenges that were experienced in Ohio.
I think the first wave of issues that we saw was with adults and juveniles who had to be reclassified by letter by the Attorney General.
Can you explain what you mean by classification too? I know you've been talking about like tier three, and I'm not sure everyone probably knows what those things are. So if you can also just explain that. I'm sorry to interrupt, but I just want to make sure
fine.
This is accessible for everyone. Thank you.
Oh, you're fine. Classification is the level to which a offender registrant must register. So the different levels, at least both in the federal act and here in Ohio, are tier one, tier two, and tier three. So those are the basic levels. However, for juveniles, there's also a fourth classification level, which is the public registry qualified juvenile offender registrant. And I'll kind of go through the line and talk about each of them briefly. But the tier one juvenile offender registrants, they must register with the local sheriff annually for 10 years. And the specifics of what they have to provide the sheriff, it's a pretty lengthy form, and they fill out their name, their address. They also fill out any identifying marks. So if the youth has any tattoos, if they wear glasses, they have to keep that information up to date. If the youth were to switch to wearing contacts or get a new tattoo, that information they have to update with the sheriff. Basically, any information that would allow the sheriff to identify them is what needs to be included on the form. Also, information about where they go to school, where they work, is also contained on the sheriff's database as well. So a Tier 1 offender registrant or a juvenile offender registrant has to update that information annually. For a Tier 2 juvenile offender registrant, he has to go in or she has to go in every 6 months for 20 years and update their information. And for the Tier 3 juvenile offender registrant, they must go in every 90 days. It's a lifetime registration requirement. The statute is actually written to say until death, so kind of giving the heaviness of that registration class itself. The Pork Tour is similar to a Tier 3 in that they have this lifetime duty to register, and they must go into the sheriff's office every 90 days, but they also have additional requirements that are vastly different from other juveniles. The public registry qualified juvenile offender registrant, or PORCTOR, also is subject to automatic community notification. So that means that the moment he registers, within, I think it's within 3 days of that, the sheriff then sends postcards out to everyone who lives within 1,000 feet of that youth address, so that all of his neighbors will know where he lives. And then if, for instance, a school is included within that 1,000-foot radius, then the school can also give that information out to other organizations who might be interested in knowing that there's a registered sex offender in the area. So those community notification provisions, they apply automatically to a porchor who's a juvenile registrant. In addition to community notification, the pork drawers are also subject to registration on the Attorney General's Electronic Sex Offender Registration and Notification Database, or ESORN. And that is the what can be accessed by individuals on the web. So the Attorney General keeps a list with pictures, addresses, license plates, offense information of all the registered adult offenders, and then all the public registry kids who are juvenile offenders and on the public registry. And that's accessible basically from any computer with internet access. So those are the, I'd say, four levels or four classification tiers that children can have imposed if they are found to be registrants.
Okay. I mean, that's great. Thank you for taking the time to do that. I think you were really talking, you're starting to speak about Senate Bill 10 and
yes.
some of the immediate sort of issues that Ohio experienced once it had been passed.
Yes.
And you were talking about reclassification, and that's where I stopped you. So.
Oh, it's fine. Reclassification affected those who already had a duty to register under Megan's Law before Senate Bill 10 was passed. Senate Bill 10, just like the Federal Adam Walsh Act, specifically required states to go back and reclassify everyone who was already registering previously. So what this meant was individuals who may have been previously what was a sexually oriented offender, which was the lowest level of offender, those individuals had their classifications changed to the specifics under Senate Bill 10. And it gets a little confusing, but the basic gist of it is that before Senate Bill 10, courts had the ability, both for adults and juveniles, to look at an individual's case and make a determination as to whether the court believed that that person might pose a future risk to the community, and then make a classification based on that examination. So it was a risk-based system. Senate Bill 10, however, is an offense-based system. And so what it required was for everyone who had been classified under the risk-based system to now receive a new classification, which for most people ended up being an increased level of duties and requirements, and then they shuffled everybody into these new offender levels. So someone who might have only had to register for 10 years or 15 years under prior law now all of a sudden became a lifetime registrant under Senate Bill 10. And that was the first wave of challenges that we saw kind of popping up, or the first issues, was just the fact of having tens of thousands of people who were suddenly found to be, in essence, a worse offender than what they had been labeled before. So I think that was the most pressing issue, in part because people who were reclassified by letter from the Attorney General had only 60 days to challenge their new classification. Around November of 2007, I think it was, the Attorney General sent out, I believe it's close to 26,000 letters reclassifying individuals, and all of those people had a 60-day window in making a challenge. This challenge process in and of itself posed some difficulties, both for adults and juveniles, but juveniles in particular because a lot of kids were either incarcerated at the time, and so there were specific rules about where those kids needed to file their challenges. A lot of courts didn't want to be the ones to deal with the challenges, so many kids who tried to file petitions had their petitions jumping from county to county, kind of in flux until they were able to connect with counsel or get some assistance. And that was one of the other issues, was that a lot of kids would show up for a hearing and then not have counsel appointed for them in their challenge. So they were really left alone in that process. The challenges themselves actually proved to be pretty toothless in that the statute limited the petitioner's ability to challenge their classification to the very slim issue of whether the attorney general had reclassified people to the right tier level. So instead of the empowering challenge ability to be able to kind of fight against the constitutionality of the reclassification, courts were merely just checking to see if the attorney general followed what Senate Bill 10 said it had to do. And so that was kind of disheartening and just kind of earth-shattering for some. We had kids who only had, you know, a year left to register under Megan's Law, and then now found out they were lifetime offender registrants, and there was nothing they could really do about that. So that was definitely in the first group of immediate issues that we saw here in Ohio. Also, we found that courts were completely left ill-prepared for kind of the rush of cases and the way that the law said that kids were supposed to be classified. We ran into a lot of issues where courts were just really confused about what Senate Bill 10 said had to be done in kids' cases. And so we saw a lot of mistakes made early on. We found by checking the Attorney General's electronic database, we found a lot of kids who were posted online who should not have been. And so that caused a lot of scrambling with trying to get them taken down so that their information wasn't public. And these were kids who were not public registrants, but somehow in the switchover were made public registrants by mistake. So we were running into issues like that. And mainly the courts just wanted a lot of help and direction with figuring out how to navigate through Senate Bill 10's provisions. So it definitely was a rocky start. I don't think anyone felt very comfortable with the way that the bill was enacted and how quickly everyone had to kind of adjust to this new system. So some helpful things that occurred shortly after those initial problems, there was an extension given on the 60-day challenge deadline, which helped a lot of people get their challenges in on time. The United States District Court for the Northern District of Ohio issued a stay that enabled a lot of petitioners, kids and adults alike, to seek out counsel, find counsel, and then try and get their arguments heard. And I think that alone helped preserve a lot of issues for kids who otherwise would have missed their deadlines. And seeing how most of, you know, the clients that we work with may not have even remembered they got the letter until day 59 anyway, having an extension was really helpful for being able to help them out. So those were our early issues. And the other, I think probably the other biggest thing that happened early on was concerning what our courts knew to do with kids. The law is not very clearly written. Anyone who I think tries to sit down and read it from cover to cover has to do it a few times to get the order of everything. But initially, courts believed that kids were to be classified in the same way as adults. And there's been debate throughout the various districts, the appellate districts in Ohio, as to which one of those is correct. The majority of districts now say that juvenile courts have discretion to pick a child's tier, which is a little closer to the risk-based system of Megan's Law. But there's still one district in Ohio that says otherwise, that says Juveniles are to be classified just like adults, based solely on their offense and not based on any of the principles that have historically driven juvenile justice.
We do have a question from a listener, which I think you were going to talk about, which have been some of the constitutional arguments and litigation around Senate Bill 10. And as I started off by saying you had two cases that you argued this week in front of the Supreme Court, and I'd like you to talk about those. But maybe right before you do, I just to give people a sense of how this has gone awry in the juvenile for youth, if you can give a few examples of some of the offenses where children have gotten caught up in this, where people might be really shocked that they have been labeled a sex offender or had to do public registration and notification.
I think one that stands out to me early on was a youth who I had as a client who had been having consensual sex with his girlfriend. At no point was it alleged that it was forcible or anything like that, and he ended up being a public registry qualified juvenile offender. So the moment he entered an admission to having consensual sex with her, he ended up on the web later that day. And that was probably one of the, I think, worst cases in which we saw the negative effects of Senate Bill 10 so quickly. Because typically the whole heart behind registration is to be protecting the community from those who would pose harm or threat to it. And in this case, we had a girl who admittedly stated that this was consensual sex, and it was her parents who had pursued the charges initially. So that was a case in which we were just kind of appalled at how this happened with this youth. The good thing is for him, he's no longer a public registry qualified juvenile offender, so that's good. But that's definitely one example of how that can happen. How just the facts of a case alone make registration just a very, very devastating end to a youth's case.
Mm-hmm. All right. So if you can talk about some of the constitutional challenges around Senate Bill 10, and then we're about halfway through. I really also want to make sure we reserve time for you to share strategies and tips to attorneys who are representing youth. So let's take about 10 minutes on sort of summarizing the constitutional challenges. Okay, great.
No problem. Right now, there's a number of constitutional issues that we've been trying to raise for kids across the state. There are four cases currently pending that raise about half of them, between the four of them. In re Smith, In re Adrian R., and In re Messmer are three ex post facto cases. These are kids whose offenses predated Adam Walsh in Ohio, predated the enactment of it, but who were classified under it. So what we've argued is that the retroactive application of the law violates the child's right to be protected from ex post facto laws, and that's retroactive laws under Ohio's constitution. That it's also a due process violation, an equal protection violation, and one issue in particular dealt with the lapse of time between the enactment of the statute and its effective date. So those three cases focus solely on the retroactive and the reaching back nature of Senate Bill 10. And part of the issue that's tied up with that is whether SB 10 is civil or punitive, because if it's civil, then whether or not it's retroactive isn't going to help our kids. But if it's punitive, which we've argued that it is, then the legislature can't do that. They can't make a new law and then impose a penalty, a punitive nature penalty on kids who broke it prior to. So those three cases really represent the notion that if this is a punitive scheme, you cannot do this to these kids whose offenses happened before it came into being. We argued these along with two adult challenges that also raised similar issues, and this was back in the end of 2009. The Supreme Court has not yet ruled on those issues, and I think it is, in the end, going to come down to this whole discussion of whether it's punitive or not. The reason why we're arguing it's punitive is just because of the sheer nature of the burdens associated with registration and the additional duties that the children have to go through, and in particular, the public nature of the community notification. Even though not every child is subject to community notification, the reality is Senate Bill 10 has written into it a provision that allows the general public to go into a sheriff's office in any county in the state and to request a list of all registered sex offenders. And that list is not limited to adult offenders, but also to juveniles. This is one of the things that we've argued to the court is particularly offensive and what makes this a punitive scheme rather than a remedial scheme for children. The fourth case that's pending raises three additional constitutional challenges for children. And this is the one I referenced earlier, In Re CP, which is a prospective challenge to a public registrant's registration requirements. In that case, we raised that it's a due process violation to have a child classified as a pork drawer because the pork drawer classification resembles the adult classification so much that because you're keeping a child in the juvenile system, to impose this adult registration system on him is really contrary to the history and purposes of juvenile court. We've argued that the court, unless the child is transferred to adult court, that there's no way that this type of classification is constitutional for him. We've also argued that it's an equal protection violation. When you look at this particular young man and pork drawers in general, they're treated significantly different than other juveniles in the system, even other juveniles who are their same age and who may even have their same offense history, so those who have the same number of offenses or who have committed the same offenses. And there's no rational relationship for or rational reason for the differentiation in treatment. The final argument we raised in CP was that the public registration scheme and the automatic and lifetime portions of the pork drawer classification are punitive, and they're cruel and unusual punishment for children. And in that, we cited to the United States Supreme Court's recent decision in Graham versus Florida, in which the court found LWOP sentences for non-homicide offenses unconstitutional for youth. We're trying to analogize the imposition of an automatic lifetime and public registration to kids because just of the nature and the differences between children and adults. So those are a handful of the constitutional challenges that we've been making and that are still being argued in the courts of appeals below. Hopefully the Supreme Court will shed some light so that a lot of these kids can at least know where they stand or what's going to happen with their classifications.
Are there other challenges happening in other states that are parallel or that we should be aware of, to be watching, that could impact what's happening here in Ohio?
Definitely. The Ninth Circuit released a decision, United States versus Juvenile Mail, last year, and it specifically focused on the retroactive application of Senate Bill 10, or of Adam Walsh, I'm sorry. Washington State's version of Adam Walsh did a lot of the same things that Ohio's version has done, which is places children on the web. It applied retroactively. In that case, the Ninth Circuit found that Adam Walsh is punitive for children, in part because of how far it takes things. The placement of children on the web, the notification cards sent out about children, the Ninth Circuit found all those things contrary to the way that we historically treat juveniles. And for that reason, they found it to be a punitive scheme. The moment they found it to be punitive, it could not be retroactively applied to children. So that was a huge victory, at least for Washington's children, because it meant all those kids who were reclassified with the new enactment got to go back to their previous enactment, which, and I'm sure it's like this with many other states, which had previously been found by a court. So that's at least promising, and that is one of the things that the justices here in the Supreme Court were interested in knowing, was whether any other jurisdictions had considered these issues. Now, unfortunately, because Ohio was so early in the game, so to speak, there's not much out there that's also helpful for us. At this point, we've got some of the earliest challenges to the state implementation. So we might be one of the first groups to get a lot of decisions out there on these issues.
So turning to those children's attorneys that are listening or will be listening, do you have tips for them on considerations when representing youth that are facing sex offense charges that they should be thinking about to preserve a record or to make sure that their constitutional rights are being protected?
Definitely. I think there's a wide range of considerations. I think the issue of consent itself is a great one to really push the court on because there's a distinct difference between the arguments that I think you can make to a court about whether a child should be a registrant for consensual sexual activity. I don't think courts take that into consideration. In fact, a couple of days ago, the argument before the Supreme Court dealt with a 12-year-old child who had consensual sexual conduct with an 11-year-old child. And even though he's not age eligible for registration here in Ohio, in other states he is. And so part of the, consideration is for children who are appearing in court for sexually oriented offenses, having the court be aware of what the potential consequences may be for that youth in the future or if they choose to change jurisdiction. So I definitely think paying attention at a time where the act alleged is consensual is important. As far as local attorneys challenging Senate Bill 10, some of the issues I think that are definitely worth keeping alive are the issues of tier discretion. As I said earlier, there's one jurisdiction in the state that is still applying Senate Bill 10 to children as though they're adults and based solely on their offense. So any counties that are within the third appellate district, I know Allen County is one of them. There are a handful of others. But attorneys in those counties should still be making that claim, even though the judges are pretty set on doing offense-based classifications. I think those are still vital issues to keep preserved. Also, objecting if there are any youth out there who are still in DYS but are about to be released and whose offenses predated its enactment, it's definitely worth it to continue to object to the retroactive application of the law to their clients. Those issues, until the Supreme Court decides them, are still very much alive and well. So any time that an attorney can make that argument for a child that he should be a Megan's Law registrant, not a Senate Bill 10 registrant, it's definitely worth it to do so. One thing that's key for most registrants, regardless of what position their child is in, if they're a discretionary registrant or a mandatory registrant, making a claim on equal protection, Senate Bill 10 makes a number of age-based distinctions that really there's no rational basis for doing so, and I think every child who's classified under Senate Bill 10 has a viable claim in that respect. Because the law treats the kids so differently depending on their age. For instance, 13-year-olds, no matter how many offenses they have, will never be registrants, while 14- and 15-year-olds, as long as they don't have any priors, they're discretionary registrants, so the court can choose not to classify them at all, while 16- and 17-year-olds, regardless of whether they're a first-time offender or a repeat offender, they're mandatory registrants, so the court has no choice, regardless of the facts as to whether to classify them. So that's definitely an important thing, I think, for counsel to keep aware of. Also extremely important is the issue of whether a court can actually classify a child or continue a child's classification once they pass the age of 21. Of particular interest to the Supreme Court when Smith and Adrian R. were argued was the issue that no matter how old these kids get, they're still going to be juvenile offender registrants. And when they try to petition the court in the future to ask to have their classification removed or lowered, they're still going to be appearing in juvenile court. And that's really a strange thing to think about, that a child who's 45 will still be in juvenile court trying to change his classification. So for defense counsel, I think that, you know, when you have a client who ages out of DYS and isn't going to get his classification hearing until his 21st birthday, and we've seen this happen where they'll try to have the hearing either on the 21st birthday or shortly thereafter, that's definitely a time to object to the hearing even being held at all, because I don't think that the juvenile courts actually had that jurisdiction. In fact, we've got one appellate district, the third, who have said juvenile courts don't have that jurisdiction to impose a classification where one did not exist once the child is no longer in the juvenile court's jurisdiction. So that's definitely another one. We have on the Ohio Public Defender's website, we have a list of objections and sample motions that defense counsel can use. That's,
do you want to give that website?
Sure. It's www.opd.ohio.gov. And we've also got a flow chart on there as well that helps to kind of help defense counsel navigate through the timing and eligibility of the statutes, because that's an entire web of things that's hard to really sift through sometimes.
Are there other resources that you can think of that you'd want to, that you think our listeners should maybe could turn to learn more about SB 10 or Adam Walsh Act or any sort of the issues as it relates to juveniles and some of the problems with this?
Well, there's definitely, I mean, there's a host of groups and advocacy organizations who try to keep updated information out there and collaborative information out there. The National Juvenile Defender Center is a great resource to find recent challenges and kind of connect with other people across the country who are also trying to fight the same legislation in their own states. And also the Department of Justice itself, as negative as the act is, it's a great place to find out the little nuances and things that they're changing or incentives they're giving states. Because I think knowing kind of what the DOJ is doing is very helpful for defense counsel to know how to strategize and help their own clients. So that's a wealth of information. I can't think of the website offhand. I apologize for that. But if you Google Department of Justice Smart Office, it'll pull up their entire resource page of Adam Walsh information and updates. And so every time a new jurisdiction implements it, they post a press release. And it's at least helpful to see or to be able to know where to look, at least when you're doing some legal research, as to what other states are doing and who might already have challenges going in their Supreme Courts.
Well, do you have any final thoughts? This, you know, is a very tough issue. We all want the public to be safe. We also want every youth to have the opportunity to be rehabilitated and to be a productive citizen. So I don't know if you have any final thoughts about this issue that you'd like to share.
I think the biggest thing is that when it comes to juveniles and subjecting them to a system like this, the thing to keep in mind is that kids are so significantly different than adults that I think the biggest thing that helps kids is early intervention and rehabilitation. Treatment really can be instrumental in a youth's life, and I think that's why juvenile recidivism rates are so low. Kids are more amenable to treatment and rehabilitation. So I think that the sad part of Adam Walsh is that these kids get labels that tend to stick with them but aren't necessarily justified. But I think with proper treatment, proper community support and family support, people can see that these, you know, lifetime registration requirements and these public registration requirements are kind of ill-wrought when it comes to juvenile offenders.
Well, Brooke, thank you so much for taking the time to be on today's show, and thank you, listeners, for tuning in. I'd also like to thank Angela, who's filling in for Ansa today behind the scenes. This show will be available on demand at blogtalkradio.com/spotlightonyouth. Patricia Campy, who is the director of the National Center for Juvenile Justice, will be on the next Spotlight on Youth discussing why NCJJ is asking A&E to discontinue its show Beyond Scared Straight and highlight some considerations for states looking to engage in reform efforts rooted in effective outcomes for youth. And that show is going to be next Friday, February 25th. To stay informed about this and other upcoming shows, you can either follow us on blogtalkradio.com or visit www.childrenslawky.org, which is the Children's Law Center's website. So take care and see you next time on Spotlight on Youth. Thanks, Brooke.
Thank you.